Today's show is sponsored in part by StrongDM. Automate access control and auditing across your entire infrastructure with features including activity and session logs, session replay, and more. Go to strongdm.com/packetpushers to start your free trial today.
Hey, everybody. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, and you've probably heard them. They're a pretty popular monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. If you'd like to know more, you can visit datadog.com/day2cloud and get your free Datadog t-shirt. That's datadog.com/day2cloud. Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Today, we're going to be talking about Kubernetes. And Kubernetes is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, the mirage in the distance that you cannot reach, the MC Hammer you just can't touch. Until you do, and you find that it's a lot of sweat and toil and baggy pants? Or what I mean to say is that while Kates seems to be a shining paragon of ops efficiency, the reality of running it is quite different. Is your organization up to the task? Is Kubernetes the thing you actually want or need? In this episode, we will be talking to Corey O'Daniel, who is a cloud solutions archaeologist, and Rishi Malik, who is a partner both at Container Heroes, all about Kubernetes. So gather close by the fire, prepare your marshmallows, chocolate, and graham crackers, and we're going to talk about why Kubernetes is wrong for you. So, Corey, Rishi, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do and what Container Heroes is. Corey, why don't you go first?
Hi, Corey O'Daniel. As you noted, cloud solutions archaeologist. I kind of started referring to myself as this a while ago because I feel like rather than architecture, which is, you know, the term we use a lot in software and infrastructure, I feel more like an archaeologist because a lot of times I'm digging through legacy applications and trying to figure out how they work, right? Like we all have an architecture, but it's just a matter of figuring out what it is. That's where that title comes from, and I love it. I do a lot of work with Kubernetes and a lot of work with Elixir. I manage the Kubernetes Elixir client and also Bonnie, a framework for extending Kubernetes with Elixir.
All right. And Rishi?
Hi, Rishi Malik, partner at Container Heroes. I spend a lot of time also on Kubernetes, but more specifically, the ecosystem, the people around Kubernetes, you know, leveling up teams, figuring out how ops teams are working on the DevOps piece, the, you know, how developers interact with Kubernetes and, you know, really helping companies, you know, moving their legacy systems over, adopt Kubernetes, and adopt, you know, cloud architecture and cloud native development in general.
Okay, great. So let's start this conversation by talking a little bit about what problems Kubernetes is meant to solve. I mean, it was designed by Googlers thinking about googly things. And I'm wondering how that, in your opinion, informed the business and technical problems that it was aiming to solve. What do you think, Rishi?
So my personal point of view on this, it's a very strong opinion that I hold, is Kubernetes is really only about one thing, and that's bin packing. Above everything else, it's about optimizing how much value you get out of your compute resources. Everything else around it, around orchestration and all other things you can do there is really just to make that process easier. So to me, that's the key point of it. And if you're not ready to start thinking with that mindset, you're not ready for Kubernetes. You don't need it.
Interesting. So when you say bin packing, you mean getting as many applications packed on a single physical host or a virtual machine as possible to get the most out of your investment? Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Exactly. You know, if you're not worried about cost to that level, if you're not trying to figure out that thing, if you're not trying to balance, you know, the scale of, you know, hundreds and thousands of servers and, you know, by extension, hundreds and thousands of instances of applications, it's not worth it. If you're investing more than you need to in that.
Gotcha. And that's not a problem that everybody has, certainly. If I've got 10 servers that run my entire data center, maybe Kubernetes is not the thing that solves my business or technical needs.
I think that's exactly it, you know, and to get back to your point about it being a googly thing, you know, that's one of the things Google was obviously originally known for, was just like their approach to scale and having to deal with all that. and they had problems. You know, the existing solutions out there weren't particularly great. They started, Borg slash, evolving into Kubernetes, and it's a great product and it suits their needs and it suits companies similar to Google. But frankly, most companies aren't Google.
So do you look at it as a, like there's a threshold or like a magic number, a size or scale where if you're there, then yeah, time to start looking at Kubernetes.
I don't know that I would say there's a specific magic number, but it's when you start to have applications kind of coming through that your DevOps and your SREs don't necessarily know about kind of well in advance, right? You don't have just that one monolithic application. You don't have, the five applications where you know what everyone's doing. It's, hey, some team has, just developed an application, has been working on it, and no one else knew about it because your company is big enough, because, there's communication challenges, because there's just so many disparate teams that all of a sudden someone says, hey, we have a business need. We have to get this done. We have this application. How do we get it out there? And I think when you start to have those kind of organizational, problems, challenges, whatever you want to call them, that's when something like Kubernetes is beginning to be a great fit for what you're doing, because you start to have some of the other ancillary issues as well.
This is interesting. You're positioning this as like a deployment tool, and I've been thinking about Kubernetes more as in a fairly capable availability tool. That is, I need to get this thing up and running. I don't care where it lives exactly. Let's schedule, figure that out. But then keep an eye on things and make sure that in accordance with all the policies that I've written, this application is available. But the way you're phrasing it, Rishi, it sounds more like, again, it's like a deployment platform to put it out there is how you see it primarily.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the way it's used frequently in the real world because of, some of the advantages of it. Because you do get, by adopting Kubernetes, you get a bit of standardization across how it works. It's not, hey, I'm a team, I'm getting my app out there, I'm putting it on Heroku, or I'm doing it in, Lambda and serverless or whatever it may be. You get the Kubernetes interface, the YAMLs, the deployment artifacts, all the objects that exist there as being your lingua franca, your communications, your ability to say, here's my app, here's how it works, here's what needs to happen, here's how it talks to other things. And that standardization, I think, becomes much more relevant when you get to a bigger size.
Right, that makes sense. Now, Kubernetes is kind of, well, it's going through the hype cycle. I think it went through the big, big hype and down into the trough of disillusionment a little bit. I'm not sure exactly where we are right now, but there's something about it that seems to attract engineers like a moth to a flame. And I guess some of us get a little burned by doing that. But I'm curious, Corey, what, in your opinion, does attract engineers to the land of Kubernetes?
I think it's obviously novel, right? So it's like, I heard this really great quote the other day, like, can you do blank with Kubernetes? It's like, the answer is probably yes. With how flexible CRDs are and making your own controllers, it's easy to do anything with it, right? We're seeing ML in it. We're seeing applications in it. We're seeing people start putting VMs in it. You can really do a lot with Kubernetes. The other question I saw in this same quote was, should you do X with Kubernetes? And like, that's, as a consultant, that's a hard question to answer. Like, usually my approach, and this kind of ties into the last question a bit, is like, when you're moving to Kubernetes, it's, have I outgrown what I'm running on now, right? Have I started running into problems that either are too timely for me to solve, or I don't know how to solve, and maybe I can solve that by moving to Kubernetes? More problems once you get there. But I mean, I think it's just there's so much that you can do with it. And the interesting thing is, like, I feel like the community is pretty good and people are building operators for everything. So it starts to seem like it's going to be very easy to do stuff, right? Like, I can sit down and just run CockroachDB and I don't have to know anything. That's fantastic. Like, why would we not do that? Right. So I think it's the community excelling at getting all these applications that we normally have to figure out how to run in our own infrastructure, easily available on Kubernetes, I think is the big appeal of it.
Right. to a certain degree, it can be the easy button for deploying an application because, hey, I've got a Helm chart that deploys a WordPress site with all the bells and whistles on it, and all I have to do is click Helm install, and I'm done. I win. I can go home. But like that easy button is masking a lot of complexity that makes it actually work. So
I need to emphasize something here for the audience. When the four of us were talking before we recorded this show, one of the points that you made to us that really stuck out was for almost all organizations, you guys are taking the position that Kubernetes is probably the wrong answer. So you guys seem to feel really strongly about this. And in a way, the answers to your question so far have kind of been like, oh, this is what it's for and this is how it fits. But you're saying what you told us, again, offline, but you told us it's really wrong for most folks. So, you know, come on, man, fire up the guns. And what are we missing here about why people are choosing it when maybe they shouldn't be?
Well, I think more on the hype cycle thing, right? So like why I think it's wrong for a lot of organizations is because I don't know. A lot of the companies I've been involved in, the number of engineers far exceeds the number of operations staff, right? And so if we start moving to something like Kubernetes and we don't have the operations staff to manage and know how it works, even if you're using like Kubernetes as a service, like there's still operational and maintenance tasks to do. That burden falls on the engineers, right? And at the end of the day, the engineers are supposed to be developing something that creates business value and is tinkering with figuring out how to, let's say, configure pod security policies. Like, does that help? I mean, it makes your applications more secure, sure. I mean, not newer versions of Kubernetes now, but whatever. But that's the problem I see with it is if you don't have that good mix of people that you can have focusing on operations, then you're taking time away from engineers and they could be building business value. And I see this happen a lot with startups, right? It's like, oh, we should be running on Kubernetes because that's where we might go in the future, right? That's like, you know, we don't pre-optimize, but we just pre-optimize where we're going to be deploying our applications in the future, right? It's like maybe just start on something like Heroku or start on a VM or something like App Engine, right? Like something smaller, something you can just run your application on, get your MVP out. Don't worry about trying to make this thing scale to infinity yet.
Right. And I think that brings up an important point that is there are other options out there when it comes to building something that's sort of cloud native. There's a bunch of different platforms as a service like App Engine, like Azure App Service, like Lambda and Serverless that you could choose to build your application on and then, I guess, backport it to Kubernetes if it ever came down to it. Is that what you'd recommend for a startup to investigate before they go, you know, full bore on Kubernetes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, to echo Corey's point, as a startup, you're not, for the, you know, bulk of the startups, for 80, 90% of them, you're not in the business of operating servers. You're not getting paid to run Kubernetes. You're getting paid to solve some chunk of business value, especially early on. Your whole goal is to prove out that there's a market, that your solution is there, and that people want to pay for it. Anything that takes time away from that risks, you know, the actual ability of your startup to exist as a company. You know, and so like, absolutely, you know, Heroku is great. You know, App Engine is great. For any of those things, ship it out there. My personal take on it is if you really want to start thinking about the future and what you do there, adopt the language that will help you down the road without having to redo everything. In this case, it's that containerization piece, right? Don't necessarily go to, you know, pure serverless or Lambda if you don't think you're going to be doing that forever. Build a Docker container. Throw it on, you know, on App Engine. Throw it on Cloud Run. Throw it on Fargate. And then at least that chunk of it is there. You know, then you go back to focusing on all your business stuff. And then when you get to that point where you're saying, you know what, we've grown, we've scaled, we really need Kubernetes for these reasons, you know, that piece is done and you can kind of slot that in and work on all the other stuff you have to develop from at that point.
So you describe some organizations that maybe get ahead of themselves and deploy Kubernetes when they shouldn't because they're not thinking about it quite right. Well, is there a particular type of organization or maybe a culture that is well-suited to Kubernetes? Is it just about the staffing and having the operations team? Or is there just a way a shop is set up where this works well?
You know, I think what I've seen work well is when, you know, a company is big enough to have folks that are dedicated to the platform, the running of Kubernetes, the maintenance of it. But, you know, they've shifted left enough to have each development team be be visible and involved in what's going on. So more specifically around that, you know, there are still lots of, you know, legacy shops where you build your app, you hand over the artifact, and it's hands off at that point, right? Somebody else is running it, somebody else is monitoring it, somebody else is dealing with everything that happens to it. You know, obviously people have, you know, started that shift left. That's where, you know, DevOps comes from, and those are all great choices. So when you have a culture where I'm going to do the development on this, I'm going to own this though, even though it's in production. It's on a platform that maybe there's SREs running Kubernetes, but I'm still thinking about how it's deploying. I'm still thinking about how the networking is working. I'm still thinking about, you know, security, the security policies and all that type of stuff. That to me is an ideal candidate for running Kubernetes.
Hey everybody, we're taking a quick break for a message from our sponsor, StrongDM. StrongDM automates access to and audits of your entire infrastructure. That includes servers, databases, and Kubernetes clusters, no matter where your employees are. Trusted by companies like Hearst, Peloton, and SoFi to manage access, you'll have more control and less hassle. With StrongDM, you can automate onboarding and offboarding and move people within roles with the click of a button. StrongDM gives you features including activity logs, session replay, one-click remote access, and onboarding and offboarding employees, contracts, and vendors with a single click. StrongDM, automate access control and auditing across your entire infrastructure. And you can start your free trial today by going to strongdm.com/packetpushers. That's strongdm.com/packetpushers. And we thank StrongDM for being a sponsor. And now, back to the conversation.
Right, I think that gets into what the impact is on an organization that does choose to go to Kubernetes, because it sounds like there's a lot of different factors we've talked about. There's the administrative overhead of even managing a cluster, whether it's self-hosted or you're using some sort of Kubernetes as a service. Like, what would the day-to-day additional workload be for the ops or the engineer that has to manage that Kubernetes environment on top of the application that's running on top of it?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's obviously like managing the nodes themselves, right? Like making sure that you have enough nodes to run all of your applications. You know, what Rishi was saying earlier about like the culture and shifting left towards DevOps, like I think that is one of the key things that you have to have in place before moving to Kubernetes. Because if we're all managing our applications, right, and we share this cluster, it's a shared resource, right? If it's all of our responsibility, it's none of our responsibility. And if you don't have that platform team that's actually managing the cluster's configuration itself, who knows what you're going to get, right? You're going to start getting containers that are running as root. You're going to have somebody be like, we ran out of nodes, so we just set the node count to 100. We don't know why, we just did, right? Now we don't ever have to worry about like running out of nodes again, right? And so like those are important things I think that you will be managing. But then there's also like, you know, we have the logging metrics, traces, et cetera, of our applications, but then there's also all that stuff for Kubernetes itself, like managing the audit logs, managing any sort of metrics and alerting from different pieces of Kubernetes itself. Like that's all stuff that we still need to pay attention to, right? Making sure that, and this is the fun one, we have this thing now that's just running tons of pods. And that's great. It's running all these pods. Are they ours? Right? Like that's the other fun part. It's like when you kubectl get and you show all the pods and you see 4,000 pods or whatever, it's like, are they all ours? Or has somebody like compromised us and started running other workloads, right? Like if each of our teams is just like kind of throwing stuff on a cluster and nobody's managing it and owning it, then it's really hard to know like what workloads are teammates or what workloads are from other teams, right?
Well, let's split this up a little bit then, because we've talked about some administrative functions and overhead. We've talked a bit about what devs and engineers might care about. We've talked about the need for operations. Let's focus on engineering for a minute here. Devs and engineers, how much do they really need to know about Kubernetes and the internals of Kubernetes and how it's really working?
So this is a funny one, right? So, you know, just enough to deploy, right? Like I can make a deployment and I can go. It's right. And my application's running. Maybe that's fine, right? I think it's an interesting place where, you know, some organizations, that line blurs, like who deploys? Is it operations? Is it CI/CD? Or is it an engineer? Who owns that? The really interesting thing is there's a plethora of applications that are trying to capture that space of like taking it away from the engineer so they don't have to know anything about it, right? So there's Draft by Microsoft. I think it came out of Deus. I think it used to be Deus Workflow or something like that. So it's a tool to make it feel more Heroku-like. So there's Draft, there's Scaffold by Google. Waypoint came out recently by HashiCorp. And all these are tools. It's just like, oh, I can just change them to my Rails app and say like Waypoint up. And it figures out like, oh, this is a Rails app and I should make a Docker container and run it in Kubernetes, right? And I don't have to know how it works anymore as an engineer, except for you still kind of do, right? So for a very specific use case, but until a recent version of Erlang and Elixir, if you ran an Elixir Erlang application in Kubernetes, it could still hog more CPU than you gave it. And it's just because Elixir and Erlang weren't container aware. So it just kind of ignored C groups and would just do whatever it wanted, right? And so as an application developer, if you weren't familiar with like how to tune your Erlang or Elixir app, you could put it on a Kubernetes cluster and become a very bad neighbor to all your other pods, right? And so there's still like weird quirks that you do have to know a little bit about where your application's running just to make sure that you can operate it efficiently, right? Like what if I'm running on a read-only file system, right? Like maybe ops has applied that in our pod security policies and I'm writing stuff to disk because I've always had a disk because I'm in a VM, right? Now it's a different world. Like that disk is going to go away unless I have, stateful set or something.
Right. It does remind me a lot of what at least the good developers would know in terms of interacting with an operating system. They didn't need to know all the guts of Linux or all the guts of Windows to interact with that operating system, but they needed to know enough about the weird quirks and if they were using a framework, how that framework was going to interact with memory and CPU and understand the constraints there. But they didn't need to know how to administer a server. They just needed to know those relevant bits. Does something like the Kubernetes certification for developers help set them up for that type of thing?
I think certifications, across the board can be very helpful to get that grounding, and the basics of what you need in place. But I think just like anything else, especially with Kubernetes, you see a lot of rapid development. I think that's one of the things that's exciting to people and exciting to engineers about getting to work on it. But it also means that, you're kind of frequently out of date with things that are happening, and you have to have the time in your day-to-day to keep up with what's going on. And so I think the certifications are a good way to like bootstrap, but at that point, things are still happening, things are still changing. And so you have to bake in that time to make it happen. And I think that's also where it then goes and becomes like a bigger concept of the Kubernetes ecosystem. I think a lot of people see Kubernetes as being this, you said operating system. And I think that's what a lot of people see it as. It's kind of like the cloud operating system, right? Now I don't need AWS specifics. I don't need GCP specifics. Mm. I just have to think about Kubernetes and it works wherever, but the details are always there. And they're always, you always end up having to know far more than you think about because every situation is still just a little bit different and you have to deal with that. And so I think that's one of the biggest challenges that people have is not, it's like some of the XKCD comics and stuff you see about like standardization. It's like, oh, there's too many standards. We're going to make a new one. Everyone's going to use this. And the answer is, well, now you have 16 standards instead of 15. And I think Kubernetes is exactly the same way in that regard.
So you're just saying it should be USB-C everywhere. I think that's what I'm hearing.
Right.
Yeah, something you mentioned earlier, and I think it's an important point to draw out here, is that you should really have a solid DevOps practice in place before you try to adopt Kubernetes. And is that to sort of help protect the developers from themselves when it comes to working with Kubernetes?
I think it's to protect everyone, to be honest. If you haven't gotten your culture to the point that you have DevOps kind of baked in and you're doing well with that, then you've added a ton of complexity jumping into Kubernetes. But you've also, kind of like the Unix philosophy, like you've given yourself enough rope to hang yourself, right? You can move very quickly with Kubernetes and you can do all the wrong things very quickly and end up, as Corey was saying, with, workloads running on your cluster that aren't yours because you stood it up and it's there, but you didn't secure it correctly. You don't know how it's tying into IAM. You don't know how all this stuff is done, and you haven't got the culture in place to manage it and to run it and to have that ownership with the shared responsibility model.
Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, a monitoring platform for cloud scale infrastructure and applications. Datadog provides dashboarding, alerting, application performance monitoring, and log management in one tightly integrated platform so you can get end-to-end visibility quickly. And it integrates seamlessly with AWS so you can start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. Try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial and installing the agent. Plus, you'll get a free Datadog t-shirt. Visit datadog.com/day2cloud to get started. That's datadog.com/daytwocloud to get started.
This is complexity. We didn't even really touch on getting the security other than it's easy to get it wrong. We didn't talk about networking, which is a whole rat's nest of possible complexities. But we should at least touch on service mesh because, oh boy, everybody seems to think you need a service mesh bolted onto your Kubernetes install. Do you actually need that? Add even more complexity? What problems is that solving for you?
It's just like Kubernetes, right? You don't need it, right? But it's going to make somebody's job easier if they understand how it works, right? So let's say we're running a monolith on Kubernetes, which is fine to do. Do you need a service mesh? Probably not, right? But when we start to have things like, let's say we have 10 or 12 services, and we want to provide a unified REST API for it, right? Or just like a unified URL that all of our requests are coming through. It might be nice to kind of stitch that together using an ingress, right? And be able to have different services all served by the same DNS name for our end user. Like that's pretty nice, right? You get into some of the other things like rate limits, quotas, access mm-hmm. controls. Like that's all stuff that you will have to solve in your applications, or not, rate limit, right? I mean, right, like solving rate limiting yourself, right? So it's nice to be able to have that in a way that can work for all of the services you have running in a consistent, like declarative way, right? We don't have to go figure out how to use this tool for one app and another tool for another. It's just like we have this at the cluster level and it works. But again, it's like you don't need it day one, and somebody needs to know how it works so they can manage it for the team effectively.
Right. So far we've seen that Kates is probably wrong for startups, and it's probably wrong if you haven't developed a good DevOps culture. Is it also wrong if you haven't refactored your application using 12-factor agile DevOps cloud native digital transformations?
Jeez, Ned.
So many buzzwords. I love it.
So, I mean, I think some parts of 12-factor, I think, are going to, like, help a lot, right? Like, having your application login standard out is going to be fantastic. We can aggregate those logs, right? Having that dev prod parity, that I feel like that helps all the time, right? Like, I know some people don't like the idea of this, but I do all my development in a Docker container, and it's the same container that I ship at the end of the day, just so I know that, like, on my Mac, it's working, hopefully, as close to improd as possible. So I think that's another one that's great. But I think that, some of the stuff starts to, like, some of it gets a little fuzzy, right? Especially when you look around, like, configuration. Like, I don't know that the definition of config in 12-factor, like, meshes well with, like, the definition of config or, like, how we do config in GitOps, right? So it's like GitOps is saying, like, oh, we put our config in Git because we know what's on production by looking at, a specific Git SHA, right? And it's easy for us to roll back. But, 12-factor says we keep it in environment variables and it's separated from the code. So mm-hmm. it's like, okay, like they're, I mean, you can say it's eventually in environment variables because it's a config map, right? But it's, I don't know, I think some of them are competing, but I think, you do have to get some of 12-factor done to have a really good experience. And even if I was running on Heroku or App Engine today, I'd still probably run using like a Docker build pack just so that I know I can easily move from Heroku to ECS, EKS, GKE, Cloud Run, Fargate, whatever it is. Like I have a path off, and I also have a nice onboarding experience for new developers, right? I can say, here's this container. It works, go. Like you don't have to install anything on your machine. I think that's a great way to just set a base culture for engineering across the board. I know a lot of people don't like developing in Docker containers, but too bad.
I think part of my point was, aside from the culture and the DevOps portions of things, there's going to be a lot, especially for traditional enterprises, of applications that just run on a regular traditional stack. They're not using any of this new technology. So would they ever be a good fit to move into Kubernetes, or until you refactor and rewrite your applications, should you just keep it on the platform you're using today?
I don't think it's an either or. right? And I think especially for a lot of these companies that are more traditional in their stack and the way their apps are designed, honestly, I see a lot of them needing a forcing function, right? They're not usually just struggling with one thing, right? There's very few, you know, awesome tech leading companies that have that traditional stack, right? And so they're doing great work across the board on keeping up with the latest data, or keeping up to date with all the latest technology, except for that thing, right? It's always, they've always got more problems than they're talking about right there. And I think that's, as weird as it can sound, Kubernetes / containerization / 12-factor / you know, DevOps, GitOps, all the buzzwords can be that forcing function to say, you know what, we're not keeping up with what we need to be doing. Things that solve our business problems have gotten harder. You know, our competitors are moving faster than we are. We want to do these new things and it's taking us longer. You know, the COVID-19 and coronavirus challenges that changed everything, we're not adapting. We can't be responsive enough because of just, you know, our engineering speed in general. And so I think adapting some of these things can be that forcing function to say, we have to do better. And I've seen this, you know, with some of the companies we consult for. Kubernetes is that like magical thing. People are like, great, we're doing Kubernetes. Like, the decision was made, people have bought in, and no one knows what it is. Hmm. But we're doing Kubernetes. And so all of a sudden it's like, hey, well, great, we're doing Kubernetes, and you have this ginormous monolithic Java app. You know, you can't really containerize it well because it's so beastly, because, you know, 5 teams, 10 teams are working on this single app as it is. Okay, now you have to start to break down that monolith. Now you have to start to figure out the CI/CD piece. Now you have to figure out how developers work in a container instead of taking 3 days to set up their dev environment every time you onboard someone new. You know, and so it is that incentive to really start to do things in a different way. Hmm. But man, it's definitely painful.
Maybe Cates is a, I don't say victim, but it's successful because the marketing and the media around it, it's probably our fault in that partly, has just been so good and so thorough, and everybody's talking about it. So for example, we had Kelsey Hightower on Day 2 Cloud earlier this year, and he makes a point that the Cates API, not necessarily the guts underneath, but the API was likely to become the de facto standard for orchestration. Do you agree with that? Some people maybe just buying into that. And if that's the case, do I therefore do like some companies seem to be doing? They're buying in, they're adopting Cates, and I guess we should hire some people that know what's going on with it.
It does resonate with me a bit. I feel like the actual power of the API itself and how extensible it is allows you to do a lot with it, right? You're even seeing, I think it's like a GCP Cloud Connector or something like that, lets you create other cloud resources through Kubernetes. Just like, oh, you want a bucket? Just set up a Kubernetes cluster first, and you can have a bucket with some YAML. Pretty straightforward. But I mean, AWS is doing the same thing, right? There's the AWS operator, which lets you make Redis instances and a few other resource types from the Kubernetes API, right? Posting its Kubernetes API CRD. So I think that, you know, will it become the de facto? It's like, I think it's going to become very popular, right? I mean, we see a lot of things already starting to use it. Now is it going to replace like the AWS API in general? Like, I don't think it'll go that far, but I think that you might see a lot of people that are using Terraform or Pulumi today maybe start using the Kubernetes API to create their resources because they have everything else in Kubernetes, right? I think it makes sense from an application perspective. Like, my application needs a bucket, right? Why do I have to sync up with the ops team for them to put a bucket in Terraform? Like, why can I not just create a bucket with YAML while I'm creating my deployment, right? Like, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think you'll see that more from the engineering side than the operations side, but could be wrong. I mean, he knows more than I do.
I don't know. It feels like across IT, if we just had, you know, one API to deal with for as much as possible, that would be nice instead of having to learn all these different APIs. So for example, if we were to look at networking specifically, there's a zillion APIs that haven't standardized yet. They're all over the place depending on who the vendor is. So, you know, going back to Kubernetes, if that is a, you know, a provider API that we can work with and know and understand and is predictable, that appeals to me for sure.
I think from an orchestration perspective, he's right that API is the standard / is, you know, becoming the standard. And I think that I would confine that to the basics of the orchestration piece, the, you know, spinning up pods, tearing them down, you know, namespaces, all the, you know, the Kubernetes stuff. that still applies to other systems, I think that is the standard. I think that really begins to break down when you get to the more ecosystem stuff of Kubernetes. So like Corey just mentioned, you know, config connector and spinning up cloud resources. And I think that's an operating system perspective of Kubernetes, where it's great. I have this one language. I can spin up a Redis instance in AWS by using this, or a Redis instance in GCP by using this chunk of YAML, but they behave very differently, you know, both from this, the actual, you know, format of the YAML you write, but also in how they interact with every other piece. And I think that's the hardest part. And there's no answer to this, I think, right now, but it's like state when you're, you know, developing applications or dealing with stuff like that. Like, it's not immutable anymore. All of a sudden the state and the knowledge of the backend that's creating a Redis starts to bleed out into the Kubernetes side, because it has to, because networking is a little bit different in each type of cloud provider. And at that point, then, you know, are you really winning by using that same API, or would it be faster and more clean and easier just to spin up a Redis instance through Terraform and, you know, leave the Kubernetes stuff out?
I think the answer is YAML. Lots and lots of YAML.
I love YAML. I'm not going to
speak in Corey's language, and I'm horrified.
It hurts me. It hurts me so much. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I listened to a podcast recently that talked about a product called Crossplane that also does similar things, where it can run in Kubernetes and it uses the operator and it can deploy all kinds of cloudy stuff, kind of like Terraform, but you need a Kubernetes cluster already running to use it. And I was like, doesn't that seem like overkill? But I like the idea that you could kind of use that API and that sort of pattern to deploy infrastructure in a way. So that part of it made sense. Having a whole Kubernetes cluster to do it, it seemed like probably overkill. I don't know. But let's say, you know, I'm at an organization. I don't think that Kates is right, but the management has decided that Kubernetes is the thing, and they have rolled in a team of consultants. Hey, maybe they're container heroes to get Kubernetes deployed in my organization. As an admin or an ops person, you know, what concerns should I have about the long-term maintenance of that Kubernetes cluster after the consultants have peaced out?
It is absolutely something to consider and to be worried about. That's actually not to put the sales hat on, but that's a big part of what we do, which is anyone can kind of come in and stand up a Kubernetes cluster. A lot of people talk to us when they've actually started doing that on their own, and then they start to run those issues of, you know, scaling it across teams, of making sure it works, and like, oh crap, like this is actually, there's a lot to it. What do we do? More specifically, like, what's the best way to do it, you know, for us, right? That's when you bring in consultants. That's when you want that, the people who have done it, you know, hundreds and thousands of times to come in and give you their experience. But I think that key point is, you know, for the teams that are there, one of the things we try and do is it's teaching, it's leveling up, it's kind of getting them that foundation to say, it is totally different than what you're used to. It's a new thing. You have to start baking this into your day to day. You have to start baking this into your culture, because everything is a little bit different now. And, you know, there's some commitment on your part that says, we're investing in this, we have to make it work. How do we train people? How do we level them up? And how do we make sure, you know, they're being effective at what they do?
Yeah, and I think it's really important, like, if an organization's decided they're going towards Kubernetes, whoever they intend to be managing it eventually, like, whether consultants are coming in or not, like, maybe not necessarily doing the CKA. If the organization wants to invest in their team members, fantastic, they should, but they should definitely get them some training, right? Like, what helps us as a consultant day one is people having some knowledge about Kubernetes when we get there. If we're trying to teach and move stuff at the same time, it can be difficult. And also, if people don't have a little bit of knowledge, they're less likely to push back on things, right? So, like, mm-hmm. we might have an opinion on something, but we might not fully understand how their application works, how it's worked historically, and how it communicates with other things. So it's like, if they have a little bit of knowledge, it can help, you know, help us design a better system and, you know, better CI/CD, better way of breaking their applications down to, you know, run them in containers. If they have a little bit of knowledge, but, you know, like I was saying, like Rishi was saying, we do a lot of training, right? And, like, that is important, because, like, one of the things that really starts to feel uncomfortable towards the end of a consult is when you're getting close to the day that you're going to leave and you don't necessarily have the confidence that the cluster is going to be in great shape a month from now, 2 months from now, right? So making sure that they have learned what they need to learn and know how to manage it going forward and can keep up on those maintenance tasks, like have an idea of, you know, like running things like Kubebench just to make sure that, you know, we haven't, you know, done anything crazy on the cluster, changed any weird configuration, and doing that periodically, right? But that is one of the things that's like most terrifying when I leave is like, I hope nobody hurts themselves. Like, hi, thanks for the check.
You were talking about training and said, well, not necessarily CKA, Certified Kubernetes Administrator training, because why? That might be overkill for some shops, or maybe something more particular to their environment is appropriate?
No, I don't have that certification. I mean, I've just spent a lot of time just reading the docs and playing with stuff and learning. So, I mean, I think it would be great if an org paid for somebody to go and get that, and that was something you're interested in doing. I know some people aren't great at testing, and I mean, you know, I have an MCSE from like way back in 2000, and I took the routing test 4 times before I passed it. Right. So it's just like, people aren't great at tests. So it's like, I don't know, to go get a certification. I know that makes some people nervous. And it's like, you can learn the same stuff by just sitting down and, you know, your org giving you time to sit down and play, not sit down and play while working. Right. Mm.
I think a lot of that too is you can learn, you know, be it on your own or be it through a certification. Again, all the like basics, all the knowledge about how to do something, but especially with things that are complex like Kubernetes, that stuff is actually the easy stuff. It's when something is going wrong in a weird way, you know, as engineers, that's what kind of like what you get paid for, right? That debugging. Yep. And you just don't get that without doing it and without screwing something up and without trying to figure out why your pod is restarting 100 times because you screwed up, you know, one tiny thing in terms of, you know, networking or security or whatever it may be. Like, you just have to go through that pain, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That's every time I think I understand a concept and then I go out to try to actually do it at the command line, it never works the first time. And if it does, I am highly suspicious. Like, there's no way that worked right. So, yeah, you need that you get a certain amount of muscle memory and just a deeper knowledge of how something actually works. So that's invaluable. And whether you take the certification or not, doesn't matter. You got to put in the keyboard time to get comfortable with it. All right, so we have kind of walked through all the different reasons why Kubernetes is probably not right for your organization, even though it might be foisted upon you. Anyway, I'd like to give both of you an opportunity at this point to kind of leave the listeners with some key takeaways from this episode, sort of summarize your strongly held opinions on why Kubernetes is wrong for them. Corey, I'll ask you to go first on that.
Using it for the, you know, resume-driven development is just not a great reason to use Kubernetes, right? Like, you are opening yourself up to a lot of things that you now have to take on and learn. You know, and I think that's with all cloud, though, right? Like, even if you're going on to ECS, like, there's still a lot that you need to learn there on how ECS works versus just running an application. So if you don't have the team at the time to devote to understanding how these cloud resources are going to work, then maybe your application's just better run in some management platform like Heroku. So I think that's one. You know, another place where, you know, Kubernetes, I don't think necessarily serves people well is if you do have, I mean, you can definitely run a monolith on Kubernetes, but if you have a monolith and it's very, very large, I don't think you get a ton out of Kubernetes versus just running it on a VM. And you certainly aren't probably going to be able to bin pack well, right? I mean, if you have something that's taking, you know, 5 CPUs or 16 gigs of RAM, that's going to take some pretty large nodes to be able to run multiple versions of it, right? And then, you know, I think the third place that it's wrong for you is probably stateful workloads. I mean, you know, I know there's a lot of really cool stuff that you can run in Kubernetes, you know, like CockroachDB, ClickHouse, all sorts of stuff. But, you know, personally, like, I don't want to be the dude that loses the data. Like, that's I don't want to be that guy. So, I mean, I still think that, you know, to date, I still run pretty much all of my transactional data on RDS. You know, I try to run everything outside of Kubernetes, state-wise, if possible. You know, one of the few exclusions to that is like Redis for caching. Like, I'll put that close to my applications, but, you know, if there's a managed service out there for data and it's got a great SLA, like, go with that.
Right, that makes sense. Rishi, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kubernetes is wrong. You know, I'm imagining I'm talking to this, you know, a person, a company right here, and I'm arguing out of them, you know, hiring us. But you know that happens, and it's a good thing to have. You know, Kubernetes is wrong for you because you don't have the scale where you're going to get any benefits from it. You don't have enough apps. You're not big enough. You're not growing and changing enough. You know, it's wrong for you there. Don't invest in that. You're just wasting your money. You know, Kubernetes is wrong for you because you don't have a team to support it. You can hire us. We can come in. We can get it all set up. And then as soon as we leave, it's going to fall over. And, you know, as Corey was saying earlier, there's no one there to continue that. There's no one who has that, you know, who has that as their job description. And, you know, alongside, I think the third takeaway is Kubernetes is wrong for you because you don't have a culture that you can be successful with this at. Hmm. You don't have a culture where you can change, you know, what you're doing. You can adapt this across the board. You can bring DevOps, ops, and security all together to focus on this for a reason. You don't have that. You're drowning under other, you know, organizational issues. So Kubernetes is wrong for you in those cases.
Wow. And those are fantastic points. And it kind of gives someone a bit of a checklist to, okay, do I have these things in place? No? Okay, maybe I need to focus on those things before I try to move my application to some, you know, fancy new platform just because I read about it in a magazine. Or, well, who reads magazines anymore? But a website. We'll go with that. So if folks want to know more about you, is there a place, a centralized place they can find you, some websites or Twitter handles that they should follow?
Yeah, you can check us out at containerheroes.com. On Twitter, I'm Who Is This Ogre? And Corey?
Yeah, I'm Corey O'Daniel, no apostrophe on everything. So a very original username there. Hit me up on LinkedIn. Definitely on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, but it's a lot more snark and comments that I delete within the hour than technology stuff.
Oh, that sounds good. And I appreciate the consistency across platforms. Sometimes that can be pretty hard to get. All right. Well, Corey and Rishi from Container Heroes, thank you for appearing today on Day 2 Cloud and telling us why Kate is wrong for us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you to our guests for appearing on Day 2 Cloud. And hey, virtual high fives to you for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we'd love to hear them. You can hit either of us up on Twitter at EC Banks for Ethan or at Ned1313 for me, or you can fill out the form on my fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. Kubernetes is a complicated beast, as we reviewed heavily in this episode, and maybe you're a vendor that has a way cool product that makes it easier. If so, we invite you to share with our audience of IT professionals by becoming a Day 2 Cloud sponsor. You'll reach several thousand listeners, all of whom have problems to solve. Maybe your product fixes their problem. We'll never know unless you tell them about it, about your amazing solution. You can find out more at packetpushers.net/sponsorship. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.